Crane Lutheran Academy. And fortunately for me and Robbie, he and his father were both terrible shots. They were especially terrible shots because they were scared out of their minds after enduring a night-long rampage of 6-foot-tall praying mantis beasts with spike-armed claws. And now they had come face to face with what they believed could only be alien invader rat boys from Mars. We knew Earl Elgin Jr. as EJ. EJ Elgin had skin the color of cottage cheese. He also had a real dynamo of an Iowa name, EJ Elgin. In the same way that Benson and Hedges says, I spend a lot of money on my cigarettes, EJ Elgin says, sperm met egg in Iowa. EJ Elgin only had one ball. EJ Elgin lost one of his testicles when he was 9 years old. EJ's father, Earl Elgin Sr., hired a giant inflatable whale-shaped bouncer house for EJ's birthday party. One of EJ's balls got stuck inside a plastic-rimmed ventilation hole near what was supposed to be the big inflatable whale's spout. It is painful to recall, but I am only doing my job. I was there. I recorded the history of EJ Elgin's detached ball. Nothing puts a damper on a boy's 9th birthday party like the loss of one of the guest of honor's guests of honor. EJ had to be taken to the hospital in Waterloo after having one of his balls detached when it became lodged in the plastic vent on a giant inflatable whale. He came home the following day with an excess of unoccupied space inside his scrotum. I do not know if doctors discarded detached human balls in the trash can or not. The boys at Curtis Crane pestered EJ for a while. After his 9th birthday party, and the horrible incident with the enormous inflatable whale, all of us, to a boy, were horrified and curious. All the boys at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy wanted to see EJ's ball sack, now that one of EJ's balls had been lost to a whale attack. By the time the boys at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy entered puberty, which is an epiphany, a kind of religious awakening as to the true magnificence of our balls, and shit like that, we all felt mournfully afraid of EJ Elgin, the boy with only one ball. EJ Elgin, to my knowledge, never named his solitary ball. The one he lost might have been appropriately named Jonah, perhaps Ahab.
Stay right there and don't move, you motherfucking rat boys from Mars, Earl Elgin Sr. said.
He nervously pointed his emptied assault rifle directly at my belly.
Dad, we caught us some alien rat fucks from outer space, EJ added. Let's shoot them in the balls.
EJ plinked a shot level with Robbie's crotch. Robbie flinched and whined. EJ only had a BB gun. The Elgin males were not especially brilliant, but they had been through a lot. I had to give them that. I said. Robbie raised his open hand in the intergalactic gesture of peace and said,
Please do not shoot us in the balls, EJ Elgin. It is only me, Robbie Breeze, and my friend Austin Zerba, who is your next-door neighbor, and we are not rat boys from Mars. We come in peace, and smoking cigarettes.
Benson and Hedges, I said. Earl Elgin squinted and tilted his head. The weapon he held was a Colt AR-15 A3 tactical carbine. It looked exactly like the paintball rifles Robbie and I carried, except if Earl Elgin had actually shot us with it, Robbie and I would both be dead gory messes. EJ Elgin had a Daisy 177 pellet rifle. If he had actually shot us with it, Robbie and I would have stinging welts on our skin, possibly on our ball sacks. He missed Robbie's ball sack. A rat boy from Mars definitely would not want to get shot in the balls with a Daisy 177. My next-door neighbors, EJ Elgin and his father, had been packing camping equipment into the bed of a pickup truck. They were planning on taking the rest of their family, which consisted of EJ's mother, who was named Rosemary, and his two younger sisters, Edie and Donna, as far away from Ealing and the monster invasion as they could get. When Robbie and I came outside of my house, carrying armloads of underwear, shaving stuff, and cup of noodles, Earl Elgin Sr. and his son, EJ, saw us and grabbed their weapons. Earl Elgin Sr. let loose a burst of rifle fire that shattered nearly every window on my house, as well as one on the driver's side of Robbie's old Ford Explorer, which had really taken a beating since the attack by Hungry Jack the night before.
Holy shit, I said.
Boxers, t-shirts, and styrofoam containers of dehydrated ramen noodles flew everywhere. Ingrid, who was not particularly startled by the gunfire, was shitting in the front yard when it happened. That was exactly when Earl Elgin Sr. told us to put our hands up and surrender, because he and his boy were going to become some kind of national heroes for capturing the invading rat boys from Mars.
Shoot them in the balls, Dad,
EJ Elgin urged.
Robbie
said.
Both of us had our hands raised in the intergalactic gesture of, please do not shoot us in the balls.
Earl Elgin, you shot my goddamned house, I said.
Earl Elgin Sr. looked confused. Earl Elgin Sr. said,
what the fuck did you creatures do with the Zerba boy?
Robbie Breeze and I did not get killed that day by Earl Elgin Sr. and his one bald son, EJ. But it took some dramatic pleading from me to stop Earl Elgin Sr. from shooting me and allow me to take my head off, so I might show him who was actually inside the clinging and form-fitting Rat Boy from Mars jumpsuit. Thank you, St. Casimir's, I said. I felt like the Virgin Saint was looking out for me and Robbie. There was no other way I could explain not being shot in the balls. We left Earl and EJ to their hurried departure preparations and got into Robbie's battered Ford Explorer. And Robbie said, holy shit, Austin, as we drove away from my house and headed toward the Del Vista Arms. What could I do? The Battle of the Del Vista Arms. I asked myself this. What could I do? Just 1 week earlier, everything was perfect. Everything was Iowa blue plaid. Robbie and I skated in Grasshopper Jungle. Shan Collins made me very horny. There were no books mentioning Catholics or masturbation available in the library at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. Ollie Jungfrau dreamed of internet porn and Saturday morning donuts with me and Johnny McKeon. All of that equaled normal. Then Grant Wallace and the Hoover Boys beat the shit out of Robbie Breeze and me. They threw our shoes up on the roof at Grasshopper Jungle because they said we were queers from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. And after that, the whole world went to shit. So what could I do? Robbie played Let It Bleed. Although it had been made more than 40 years before, it seemed like every song on that Rolling Stones album was precisely about Robbie and me, or Unstoppable Soldiers, Ealing, Iowa, and McKeon Industries. Robbie sang, we all need someone we can feed on, and if you want it, you can feed on me. I said. We smoked cigarettes. Ingrid sighed and yawned in the back seat. And at the exact moment we pulled up to Robbie Breeze's apartment, the cook from the destroyed pancake house, Lewis, whose real name was Ah Wong Singh, happened to be hiding inside a cinderblock cubicle where dumpsters were stored at the Del Vista Arms. Lewis's clothes were ripped. He was missing one shoe and his shirt hung open. Dried blood stippled his torn cook's trousers. But he was very, very happy to see us. He also did not glow red when I looked at him through the eyes of my grimacing lemur mask. But Lewis was so psychologically worn from what he had seen and been through that he did not even seem startled by the Rat Boy from Mars with the fully automatic AR-15 A3 tactical carbine replica paintball gun. Good morning, Lewis, I said. I waved my open hand in the intergalactic Rat Boy from Mars gesture of, this is the end of the world, but I am politely greeting you anyway. Robbie said. Robbie Breeze was not wearing his grimacing lemur mask.
It's just us, Lewis. Me and Austin from the secondhand store. You know, Austin Zerba, the Dynamo Kid.
Robbie Breeze held up a lit cigarette in the intergalactic gesture of, we are the skater kids who smoke in the alley and shit like that. Lewis had not slept in 2 days. He was spent. He'd had sexual intercourse with Robbie Breeze's mother 3 times in the previous 24 hours. After he ran away from the carnage at the Kelsey Creek Bridge, Lewis came back to the Del Vista Arms, thinking he would find safety and Connie Breeze. Instead, Lewis found the unstoppable soldier called Hungry Jack. The end of the world was 1 week old, and people everywhere were finding out about it. And the Battle of Ealing began that morning at the Del Vista Arms luxury apartments. Here is what happened. Hungry Jack was confused, and Lewis was a very motivated runner when being chased by unstoppable soldiers. Hungry Jack had been huddling beneath the aluminum roof that covered a row of cars at the Del Vista Arms when Lewis ran through the parking lot. Unstoppable soldiers are like cats in that they are stimulated by movement. They are also like walleyes in that they only want to do 2 things. The 2 things walleyes and unstoppable soldiers want to do is fuck and eat. Unstoppable soldiers are not as intelligent as either cats or fish. So when Lewis managed to slip inside the dumpster corral, Hungry Jack looked around for a while and then forgot what he had been looking for. Unfortunately for Robbie and me, Hungry Jack became stimulated by the movement of a rat boy from Mars in a tight blue and white jumpsuit. The unstoppable soldier that had hatched out from Hungry Jack's body in a cornfield outside of Waterloo, while Robbie and I stood in horrified amazement and watched it happen, became very aroused by the motion around Robbie Breeze's Ford Explorer. Hungry Jack flitted down to the lot from the rooftop of the car park. I saw him first.
Through the lenses on my grimacing lemur mask, a brilliant flash of red caused me to momentarily consider that I had indeed ignited the flammable, carcinogenic, messed-up sperm-causing mask with my Benson & Hedges cigarette. Hungry Jack looked like a ball of flame as he flew down from the awning above the car park. "Holy shit," I said. "These things really do work." I was impressed by the technology of the grimacing lemur mask. Unfortunately, I should have been more impressed by the speed with which Hungry Jack closed the distance between us. It was also impressive how Hungry Jack picked me up by my head. Until that moment, I had never in my life been picked up by my head. I did find myself marveling for an instant at how well the grimacing lemur mask protected my skull from the piercing barbs of the studded spikes all along Hungry Jack's trisegmented pincers. But it was only an instant. Then I screamed. And while I was screaming, Hungry Jack unhinged his bear trap mandibles in order to crush my rat boy skull. I looked over at Robbie, thinking my beautiful friend, a person I loved very much but had also inflicted a great deal of pain upon, was going to be the last image burned into the screens of my dying eyes. Robbie Breeze stood there, looking more cool and superhero-ish than any Lutheran boy from Iowa ever did, calmly smoking a cigarette while his eyes, which were the color of Robin Egg Cadbury chocolate Easter treats, focused directly on the monster that was just about to eat my head. Robbie raised his paintball gun and let go a burst of three rounds that splattered into Hungry Jack's mouth and compound eyes. Pop, pop, pop! The paintballs gushed. The unstoppable soldier received a faceful of the blood of his god. Fortunately, this caused Hungry Jack to release his vice clamp on my head. I hit the ground, and Hungry Jack reeled away from the concussion of the blast. "Shit! Shit! Shit! Holy shit!" was all I could say. Excrementum sanctum. And while unstoppable soldiers' exoskeletons are as impenetrable as the hull on an aircraft carrier, the blood of their god rusts every rivet in their construction and sinks them on the spot. "Glad we didn't have to use my sperm," Robbie said. I said, dazed, on my hands and knees in the parking lot at the Del Vista Arms. "Thank you, St. Casimir's. And thank you, Robbie Breeze." Lewis, whose real name was Ah Wong Sing, cowered in the doorway to the dumpster corral. Hungry Jack hissed and gurgled. The unstoppable soldier looked confused. If such an expression could manifest itself on the face of a 6-foot-tall beast that looked like a praying mantis. Hungry Jack's left arm fell off first. The right arm disjointed and plunked down onto the ground seconds later. The tooth-spiked claw arms rattled around on the pavement of the parking lot, spastically opening and closing, as they scraped along the ground with no coherent mission. Where the claw arms had detached from Hungry Jack's thorax, a gooey stream of slick yellow fluid burbled like twin pots of boiling unstoppable cornmeal mush. Then Hungry Jack's chin lowered, and his head rolled away from his body, landing on the ground between the two flailing arms. What was left of Hungry Jack scampered away on four gangly legs, which soon became three, then two, and the entire unstoppable soldier collapsed in puddles of oily mush. Robbie Breeze saved my life. Being a historian naturally has its dangers, but this is my job. I tell the truth. The end of the world. At the conclusion of the First Battle of Ealing, which took place in a parking lot at the Del Vista Arms luxury apartments, the unstoppable soldier that had once been growing inside a homeless man named Hungry Jack lay in a soupy yellow mess of jumbled bug parts. At that moment, there were only three unstoppable soldiers remaining on the surface of the planet called Earth. They were Tyler Jacobson, Travis Pope, and Travis Pope's wife, Eileen, who had filled Dwayne Coventry's house on Onondaga Street with a jellied, pulsating black goo of fertilized eggs. Robbie Breeze and I, the two rat boys from Mars who were the only people capable of saving the planet called Earth, had no way of calculating how many other unstoppable soldiers there were, and no way of knowing where to look for them. So Robbie put on his grimacing lemur mask, and the two of us entered the hallway of the Del Vista Arms luxury apartments. Ingrid, my silent golden retriever, and Lewis, the equally silent cook from the most certainly closed-down pancake house, cautiously followed. We were there to save Robbie's mom, Connie Breeze.
"Ah!"
screamed Eunice Mayhew when Robbie Breeze and I entered the hallway of the Del Vista Arms. Eunice Mayhew was the manager of the Del Vista Arms. At the exact moment Robbie and I stepped through the entrance that led in from the parking lot, Eunice Mayhew was posting two more pay-or-quit notices on locked doors to silent apartments. Eunice Mayhew did not glow red. Eunice Mayhew was 53 years old. She had a figure like an upended pickle barrel and was just about the same height. Her hair was the color of cigarette ash, and her skin had a similar hue to the gritty waterline around Robbie Breeze's bathtub, where I'd showered after spending the night with Robbie earlier that week. I know that you would not eat either one of those things, cigarette ash or the ring inside Robbie Breeze's bathtub. I also do not believe an unstoppable soldier would eat Eunice Mayhew.
Ah!
Eunice Mayhew screamed again. She threw her hands up in what I suppose was the intergalactic gesture of, I surrender to the conquering rat boys from Mars. If somewhere there existed entire planets of Eunice Mayhews, Robbie Breeze and I would rule the cosmos. Eunice Mayhew was also a very solid Iowa name. A name like Eunice Mayhew says, sperm met egg in Iowa, and zygote grew up to become a bingo-playing, quilting square dancer with a body like an upended pickle barrel. At the exact moment Eunice Mayhew screamed and two rat boys from Mars occupied the hallway at the Del Vista Arms, Shan Collins was lying down on her bed inside the Eden Project silo. Shan was scared, and she was crying too. Wendy and Johnny McKeon assumed their daughter was crying because Shan was scared about the monsters and worried about her friends who had gone out hunting the beasts. It was not exactly why Shan Collins was crying. Earlier, Shan and Johnny had crawled up to the surface in order to use their cell phones. There was no more cellular service at all in Ealing, Iowa. Shan and Johnny saw the forest-like columns of smoke that ringed the horizon. They had gone back inside Eden, and Shan slipped into her bedroom, where she lay down on her bed and cried. The night before, Shan Collins and I had sexual intercourse on the floor of the Eden bowling alley, while I stared at a pair of shoes that had belonged to Wanda Mae Rutkowski. The healthy Polish sperm I deposited inside Shan Collins' vagina found its way to a receptive egg. Shan Collins was already pregnant, and she did not know anything about it. The new universe began in Eden 1 week after the end of the world began in Ealing. Eden 5 needed us, and Shan Collins and I were Adam and Eve to every new human. I had unstoppable sperm. Dr. Grady McKeon would have been very pleased. As Shan Collins, who was pregnant with a strong Polish boy who was going to be named Eric Unze Sturba, cried on her bed, a volcano named Huacamoctli in Guatemala exploded in a massive eruption that blacked out the sun. Everything in the village of Pocomchi rattled and shook. Rocks and burning ash from the angry sky bombarded the little village. Robbie's father, Robert Breeze Sr., his wife, Greta, and two-year-old son, Hector, tried to leave their small home. Robert Breeze Sr. could not start his car. The car's motor was strangled in the steaming ash that turned everything into a dead gray night. Robert, Greta, and Hector Breeze choked in the noxious smoke. They covered their faces with damp cloths and began walking away from their small house. It was not a good idea. In a cave in Spain, at a place called Altamira, a painted bison lay folded in death, his nose pressed to the ground, mouth open, one tired and defiant eye staring and staring and staring. He had been staring that way for 15,000 years, neither dead nor alive, trapped by history with his nameless balls pressed down into the ground between his curled hind legs. Altamira means high view. At exactly that moment, the Vice President of the United States of America was being escorted through Eric Christopher Zerba's hospital room in Germany. The Vice President of the United States of America patted my brother's shoulder and said to him, "The United States of America thanks you, son." The Vice President of the United States of America did not know anything at all about what was happening in Iowa. But he did know that Eric Christopher Zerba had lost his balls. It made the Vice President of the United States of America uncomfortable to think about a healthy young boy like Eric Christopher Zerba losing his balls to a bomb blast in Afghanistan. The Vice President did not know exactly what to say to Eric. What can you say to a kid who lost his balls? All the boys at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy already knew there was no good answer to that. We all learned that lesson when E.J. Elgin's ball was torn off by a whale. The Vice President of the United States of America was very pleased that his own balls, which he had named Theodore and Franklin, were just fine. At exactly that moment, three massive National Guard helicopters flew at a very low altitude directly over the Del Vista Arms luxury apartments. The darkened hallway where we stood rattled and shook.
"Don't be afraid, Mrs. Mayhew," Robbie said. "It's just me, Robbie Breeze."
Eunice Mayhew kept her hands up. She recognized Robbie's voice. Anyone who knew Robbie Breeze would recognize his voice. Robbie's voice was perfect and smooth. Robbie Breeze's voice sounded the way soft vanilla ice cream feels and tastes inside your mouth on a blistering summer day,
And when he sang, Robbie Breeze could make a lump form in my throat. Eunice Mayhew cocked her head like a confused barrel-shaped Orpington hen. She said,
"Something crazy is going on around here, Robbie. Was that you and your friend dressed up like giant bugs this morning?"
"No, ma'am," Robbie answered. "My friend, Austin and me were only dressed up like lemurs." "Rat boys from Mars," I corrected. Robbie left the key to his apartment hanging from the ignition switch in his Ford Explorer. He knocked and knocked on the door to his apartment.
"Mom," Robbie said to the door, "wake up. I left my keys in the car. Mom, you need to let me in."
Connie Breeze was asleep. She did not expect her son, Robbie, to be dressed as a rat boy from Mars. It was Friday morning, and Robbie was supposed to be dressed up as a Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy boy from Iowa. Connie Breeze also did not expect her son to be accompanied by a second Lutheran rat boy from Mars, a golden retriever that could not bark, and Lewis, the cook from the pancake house, with whom she had sexual intercourse using condoms she found on the floor of her 16-year-old son's bedroom just the day before. It was obvious Connie Breeze did not expect any of this because she was wearing nothing but low-cut silk panties and a pale violet plunge bra. Connie Breeze had very large tits and fine golden strands of silky fuzz that lay smooth and flat between her navel and the waistband on her panties. Connie Breeze's skin was the color of perfectly prepared, soft and warm buttered toast. Her eyes matched Robbie's, and her hair, which fell softly over her bare shoulders, was the color of apple spice cake. I said. Robbie's mother made me very horny. I definitely wanted to invite her to Eden. I was not so sure about taking Lewis, though. Wendy McKeon's pancakes were just fine. I wondered if Robbie Breeze would disapprove if I had sexual intercourse with his mother. I already knew how much it hurt his feelings that I had done it with Shan Collins. I sighed. I was very confused. Robbie Breeze was a good son. He did not have to be a good son. Nobody would expect it of him, unless you really knew Robbie, and maybe loved him too. Connie Breeze did not glow red. Robbie took off his grimacing lemur mask and kissed his mother. They held each other like they knew everything that had ever happened on every road that crossed beneath our feet. I was happy for Robbie and Connie Breeze. Pictures of Robbie and Shan. Here are two pictures I drew the week the world ended. Robbie Breeze is sitting on the floor of his bedroom. He leans back on his elbows, and there is a half-empty bottle of sweet white wine standing open beside his hip. Robbie is not wearing a shirt. In the picture, which was drawn on Monday night, Robbie Breeze is wearing nothing but some tight, white cotton underwear with colorful tigers printed on them. His chest is square and flat, and his belly relaxed and soft. The perspective of the picture is from where I sit, cross-legged and in my socks, on top of Robbie's bed. I am floating. We are laughing. There is a cigarette held between the first two fingers of Robbie's right hand, which comfortably rests on his belly. The paper I draw on in my history book still smells of our cigarettes and wine. Robbie's skin reminds me of the warm insides of a late summer white peach. Those peaches are named Babcock. Robbie's hair is the color of a graham cracker pie crust. I can almost hear the music playing from Robbie's stereo. Robbie is smiling, and we are reciting our favorite poems above the jangling vocals on a song called Live With Me. The picture makes me feel like I am floating again. Shan Collins sits on the staircase that leads to nowhere from her bedroom in the McKeon house. She is framed in an open doorway above, and narrow walls of distressed brick to either side of her. The perspective is from below, looking up at Shan Collins from her dungeon for horny Lutheran boys. I draw it so her shorts, as they did, gap open just a bit, and there is a mysterious centering to the warm spot between Shan Collins's legs. I think about her pubic hair and the moistness in that perfect locus. It is history. It is the truth. Shan's blouse opens slightly between the third and fourth button. I can almost smell the ginger and orange blossom lotion she smooths on her skin. Her hair is summer wheat, and her skin is the color of a perfect October butternut squash. Shan Collins is smiling, and her eyes are scolding. I imagine I am explaining to her every wrong I have ever committed. There is nothing I can do. It is my job to tell the truth. The picture makes me feel like the luckiest boy at the Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy end-of-year mixed-gender mixer. And it is the first time Shan Collins has ever danced with me. It makes me feel like seventh-grade Austin Zerba, whose best friend, Robbie Breeze, teaches him in secret how to dance with someone you love. History will show that eighth-grade boys are never aware of the roads they have built, nor the ones they are standing on.
I love Shan Collins so much I'm afraid it is killing me. I love Robbie Breeze the same way. I am an unstoppable train wreck to their lives. The Intergalactic Bug Cops. Robbie's Ford Explorer was running out of gas. It was a matter of reasonable debate which would happen first. Would the gas run out, or would the old car simply give up and die? Bang, 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 went the thrown rod inside the Ford's crankcase. We left the Del Vista Arms with two new citizens for Eden, Connie Breeze and Lewis, whose real name was Ah Wong Sing. I thought Eden would be too crowded now. I did not want any more boys down there. Eden was only big enough for me and Robbie Breeze. I could make allowances for Johnny. It was selfish, I know, but it was how I felt. That is the truth. While Robbie drove away from the Del Vista Arms, I plucked up my St. Casimir's medallion and put it into my mouth. We'd found a chapel in Eden. It was little more than a small broom closet, but it had a church-like appearance. There is a particular kind of angle and aesthetic to all churches. The same quality is exhibited by coffins and urinals. You know what function they serve as soon as you see them. These are the things that require neither signs nor labels. Churches, coffins, and urinals all proclaim, "This is what I am." No questions asked. At the exact moment Robbie and I drove away with Lewis, Connie Breeze, and Ingrid, my golden retriever in the back seat, I decided that I was going to become a Catholic, like I was always supposed to be, like all the Sturba men always had been. St. Casimir's blood was in me, even if he did die a virgin. St. Casimir's brought a dead girl to life, and he saved me from having my skull crushed by Hungry Jack. Thank you, St. Casimir's, I said. Near Amelia Jenks Bloomer Park, two National Guard soldiers stood in the road beside an armored vehicle. They waved their hands at us, palms forward in the intergalactic gesture of, "We have guns, so you better stop, motherfucker." We should have known the intergalactic bug cops would show up. Robbie said. I said. I wonder if they are going to give us tickets for underage smoking of cigarettes, Robbie offered. I wonder if they are going to shoot us for being truant rat boys from Mars, I said. The truth is, the two National Guardsmen nearly did shoot Robbie and me for being rat boys from Mars who were also ditching school. We had no way of knowing that school, like everything else in Ealing, Iowa, had ceased to operate, due to the end of the world and shit like that. Coincidentally, Robbie Breeze and I were both wearing our grimacing lemur masks as we sat in the front seat of the dying Ford Explorer. One of the guardsmen glowed red. "Holy shit, Rob," I said. "I see it," Robbie concurred.
"What's wrong?"
Connie Breeze asked from the back seat.
"Nothing," I said, in the intergalactic teenage response to any question ever asked.
Robbie corrected me.
"That stocky guy on the left is going to turn into one of those bugs."
And from the backseat of Robbie's Ford Explorer, Lewis finally spoke. He said,
"Shit."
"How could that happen?" I said.
"Those McKeon guys didn't know shit about what they were doing. Their experiment never got outside their lab," Robbie said.
"You deserve a Nobel Prize, Rob," I said. I dreamed of going to Sweden with Robbie. I hoped he would let Shan come, too. Connie Breeze reached over the back seat and touched Robbie's shoulder. Connie said,
"Do you know what's going on, Robert?"
She liked to call her son Robert. I liked the way it sounded, too. Robbie said,
"It would take hours to explain, Mom. Austin and I will tell you everything."
I said. I did not want Robbie and me to tell his mother everything. Robbie stopped the car in the middle of the road. Both of the National Guardsmen showed edgy, wide-eyed alertness. They were obviously uncertain as to how to respond to the two monsters in blue and white jumpsuits driving a beat-up Ford Explorer through the ruined town of Ealing, Iowa. History will show that it is exactly times like these that having a grown-up and a golden retriever in the backseat of your Ford Explorer, when you were also dressed as a truant rat boy from Mars, has potentially life-saving benefits. The guardsmen, who were armed with M16s, also thought Connie Breeze was very sexy, which provided a considerable anesthetizing influence over our detainers. An M16 rifle is the military equivalent of a Colt AR-15. The difference is that the guardsmen's M16s had 30-round clips and were fully automatic. Also, unlike Earl Elgin, I did not believe the soldiers would miss Robbie and me if they decided to shoot. Enola Gay and Bo Barton's Boner. Connie Breeze showed the soldiers her breasts and FedEx identification badge. She explained that she was taking her sons and husband to safety in Waterloo. Robbie's mother did not actually expose herself in front of her teenage sons, but she did elevate her chest, the way that some women do, as though she were hoisting a battle flag before a lesser enemy. It made me happy to think of Robbie as my brother, but I was not comfortable with the idea of Ah Wong Sing being my father. It was quite obvious that he would have had to be our stepfather, and no son ever likes his stepfather. That is a fact of history. The guards' names were Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas. Bo Barton had a real dynamo of an Iowa name. Florencio Villegas did not. Also, Florencio Villegas had somehow been infected by contaminated MI plague strain 412E. Nobody had any way of knowing how that came to be. Later, when Robbie Breeze and I discussed poetry, science, and history one evening in the Library of Eden, we concluded that somehow, the dead unstoppable soldiers may have developed unstoppable mold. Or perhaps the mold grew on the egg masses that were deposited in Duane Coventry's home on Onondaga Street. Maybe, we conjectured, Florencio Villegas happened to pass through the alley where we skated in Grasshopper Jungle when Robbie's blood was fresh on the pavement after Tyler Jacobson dropped the moldy blue universe from inside Johnny McKeon's office to splatter over everything. Whatever the origin, it did not matter. We would never know with absolute certainty. Histories are actually full of conjectures. Those conjectures become so accepted by descendants and readers that time itself is forced to rearrange its own furniture. This is a new history, and I cannot do such a thing. The end of the world was fully 1 week old, and the only human being on the entire planet called Earth with the capacity to stop it was my best friend, a 16-year-old homosexual Lutheran boy from Iowa named Robert Breeze Jr. Florencio Villegas was born in Topeka, Kansas. Florencio Villegas was a diesel mechanic in Cedar Rapids. He would be dead within 30 minutes. Bo Barton worked as a bagger at a grocery store in Boone County. He would also be dead within 30 minutes. Bo Barton was 24 years old and smelled like mouthwash and chewing tobacco. Bo Barton was actually related to me in a distant and illegitimate Iowa by marriage way. Bo Barton, like me, was Phoebe Hildebrandt's great-grandson. Nobody ever knew Bo Barton's actual great-grandfather was the Catholic priest who counseled Phoebe for years following the death of her first husband, Unze Sturba. Everyone in Iowa City assumed the semen that created Bo's grandfather, a man named Eldon Wayne Barton, came from the balls of Daniel Barton, whose balls did not work so well. Daniel Barton was the radio station owner Phoebe Hildebrandt married after her husband, Unze Sturba, was shot in the head while taking a shit during the Battle of Cisterna in Italy during World War II. All roads keep crossing and crossing at the point of my pen. Nobody ever knew anything about Bo Barton and me. Bo Barton adjusted his penis conspicuously as he leaned his face through my window. He was attempting to assess the threat level of the smoking rat boys from Mars and the woman with the large tits in the back seat. Bo Barton, my cousin, had an obvious erection. He stared and smiled, practically drooling at Connie Breeze. Bo Barton thought he would most likely masturbate in the trees by the creek later that day if nothing was happening. He would not get that opportunity. Bo Barton was sweating. He showed obvious embarrassment when he became aware that I was looking directly at the camouflaged bulge caused by his swelling erection. Bo Barton was an idiot. When Bo Barton was 14 years old, he unintentionally burned down his family's garage in Boone County, Iowa. It happened when Bo Barton set fire to a plastic model of the Enola Gay. Bo Barton the teenager loved to build models and then set fire to them. Fires and big tits gave Bo Barton, the 24-year-old National Guardsman, unstoppable hard-ons. Lewis and Ingrid may just as well have been invisible to Bo Barton from Boone County. He probably might have noticed them had they been engulfed in flames. The Enola Gay was a plane named after the mother of Paul Tibbetts, who was its pilot. History will show that Enola Gay Haggard Tibbetts is the only mother who ever shared her name with an airplane that killed at least 1/10 of 1 million human beings. Paul Tibbetts was covered for Mother's Day gifts after naming a plane with such a reputation after his mom. Paul Tibbetts grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is also where Florencio Villegas repaired diesel engines. Orville and Wilbur Wright invented the airplane. All roads converged at Kelsey Creek Bridge. At that exact moment, Bo Barton, the very aroused National Guardsman, wanted to do only two things. He wanted to put his penis between Connie Breeze's breasts, and he wanted to go back home to Boone County, Iowa. Boone County, Iowa is named for Nathan Boone, who was the youngest son of Daniel Boone. As far as I know, neither Nathan Boone nor his father ever wore coonskin caps. They also never killed more than 100,000 people. I wore an artificial coonskin cap that had been made in China on the day my 15-year-old brother, Eric Christopher Zerba, got his first blowjob in a Nashville hotel from two prostitutes named Tiffany and Rhonda. Eric liked his blowjob. Eric also started calling me Boonie ever since that trip we took to Nashville, when I was only 9 and Eric got a blowjob. When I was 9 years old, I could not understand why my 15-year-old brother Eric would let Tiffany and Rhonda talk him into putting his penis inside their mouths. But when I was 9, I also could have just as easily lost my balls in a whaling accident and never known the difference. Boys' attitudes about their balls and putting their penises in someone else's mouth changed significantly sometime after the age of 9. The soldiers wore the kind of camouflaged battle dress issues that troops used in Afghanistan, which is where my brother lost the lower portion of his right leg and both of his testicles. With those uniforms, the National Guardsmen did not blend in so well among things like Iowa cornfields and rivers with spawning walleyes and shit like that. Robbie and I took off our masks so Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas would not kill us, and so they would see we were just normal-looking 16-year-old Iowa brothers who happened to be wearing matching blue and white jumpsuits, which also did not blend in so well. Bo Barton was mad at me for staring at his erection. He said,
"Are you boys in some kind of dance club or something?"
I said. Robbie answered,
"We work at a car wash in Waterloo. These are our car wash uniforms."
Robbie truly deserved a Nobel Prize, $1 million, and a trip to Sweden with me and Shan, if he would let her come along. Bo Barton said,
"Those are some real humdinger outfits they make you boys wear."
People in Boone County, Iowa used words like humdinger. The Battle of Kelsey Creek Bridge. Ealing, Iowa was being evacuated by the National Guard. Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas had been posted on the road to Kelsey Creek Bridge. Their job was to ensure traffic moved in one direction only. That direction was away from Ealing. Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas instructed us to follow them across Kelsey Creek Bridge. They drove ahead of Robbie's Ford Explorer and their armored vehicle. They decided to escort us around the wreck of Ollie Jungfrau's Dodge Caravan minivan. Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas wanted to be certain we made it safely to the highway that connected Ealing to Waterloo. It was very kind of them to do that, but it was not a good idea. Someone had already placed a yellow tarp over the smashed front end of Ollie Jungfrau's Dodge Caravan minivan. There was also a dripping black X spray painted on the tarp. The National Guard were real dynamos at covering dead things with plastic. We had seen dozens of tarps in Ealing on our drive away from the Del Vista Arms. The tipped-over eyewitness news van was entirely blanketed with them. It looked like an inflatable bouncer house you might rent for a kid's birthday party. Watch your balls. Ealing had become the plastic tarp capital of Iowa. Unstoppable tarps! Unstoppable tarps! No one at all knew what the hell was going on in Ealing, Iowa, except for me and Robbie Breeze. Unfortunately for Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas, just as their vehicle crept past the wreckage of Ollie Jungfrau's van, the unstoppable soldier that used to be a Hoover High School punk named Tyler Jacobson, still hopped up on meth and confused after his first sexual experiment, appeared, standing in the middle of the road at the end of the bridge. And just behind Tyler Jacobson was the unstoppable soldier that had hatched out of Travis Pope. They only wanted to do one thing at that exact moment. Tyler Jacobson and Travis Pope had also molted during the night. They were now 8 feet tall, with abdomens as thick as telephone poles. Lewis whimpered in the back seat. Lewis knew all about unstoppable soldiers and the things they liked to do. The armored vehicle stopped. Robbie said,
"Holy shit."
I said, "They, got bigger." Robbie Breeze's sputtering Ford Explorer chose that exact moment to die. We were stuck on Kelsey Creek Bridge. I said. The doors of the National Guard vehicle opened on either side. Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas popped out of the cab, their M16s raised and ready. It looked like a scene from an action movie. Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas had guns, motherfuckers. It was a very bad idea. Connie Breeze said,
"Oh my God."
Ingrid yawned. Lewis threw his arms around Connie Breeze. He buried his face in Connie Breeze's hair and turned away from the spectacle that unfolded on the bridge ahead of us, through the windshield of Robbie's dead Ford Explorer. In the creek below us, walleyes spawned and spawned. Carried on Kelsey Creek's steady current, Mrs. Edith Mitchell's body had already drifted into the Cedar River. I found myself thinking about St. Casimir's and contemplating why people said things like, "Oh my God," at times like these. If there really was a God, I thought, Why would Connie Breeze want to lay her claim to a deity that unleashed unstoppable soldiers on human beings caught on a bridge above Kelsey Creek in Iowa? Johnny McKeon had one tattoo on his entire body. On his right forearm, in blurry blue-green ink, which is how all tattoos look on men as old as Johnny McKeon, who had also served in the United States Navy, was the image of Sputnik. Beneath the satellite was an inscription that read, "Oh my God." Johnny McKeon told me that his father, who was also Dr. Grady McKeon's father, looked up into the starlit sky above Iowa the night the Soviet Union launched Sputnik and said those exact three words. "Oh my God." Johnny McKeon's father believed it was the end of the world in 1957. Johnny McKeon's father had a heart attack as soon as he said those three words. He died when Johnny was an infant. Oh my God. History will probably verify that "Oh my God" was among the first idiomatic exclamations uttered by human beings. The phrase has persisted for at least 20,000 years. "We killed this big hairy thing, and this big hairy thing, and then we did a little experiment. Oh my God." You know what I mean. If God had satellite TV, he was probably tuned in to the Battle of Kelsey Creek Bridge. Maybe he and St. Casimir's were sitting on a cloud couch together, nibbling unstoppable popcorn and watching what happened to us, and to Bo Barton and Florencio Villegas, too. The National Guardsmen's machine guns spit bursts of metal-jacketed bullets at the unstoppable soldiers. The sound was electric and terrifying. The bullets may just as well have been candy sprinkles on unstoppable frosted cupcakes, because they had absolutely no effect at all on the monstrous praying mantis beasts with blade-spiked arms. Tyler Jacobson and Travis Pope walked through the spray of bullets like they were cats walking through darkness, like beauty pageant queens parading through swirling showers of glitter. If the unstoppable soldiers even noticed the bullets careening off their exoskeletons, they did not show it. Tyler Jacobson snatched Florencio Villegas between the pointed blades that ridged his crushing arms. Tyler Jacobson began devouring the soldier, boots, helmet, body armor, and all. Some of Florencio Villegas's blood splashed over the metal hood of the armored vehicle he'd been driving just moments earlier. Tyler Jacobson even tried to eat Florencio Villegas's M16. He spit it out. Travis Pope attempted to fight with Tyler Jacobson over the meal he was making of Florencio Villegas. Bo Barton bravely fired and fired at both of the unstoppable soldiers while they ate and sparred over Florencio Villegas's right leg. That was exactly when Travis Pope noticed the other, as yet uneaten, National Guardsman. "It was not a good thing for my second or third cousin, or whatever sharing a great-grandmother made Bo Barton to me. I got out of Robbie's car first." For a moment, stunned, Robbie Breeze and I had sat there, watching what was happening on the bridge ahead of us. Then I realized we were all stuck anyway, and Robbie and I still had our paintball guns that were loaded with the blood of a real cigarette-smoking homosexual teenage god. As soon as my feet hit the tarmac of the bridge span, Robbie shouted, "Austin, hey, what the hell are you doing?" Tyler Jacobson was covered with blood and bug spit. He also had a foot-long length of Florencio Villegas's webbed belt dangling from his left mandible like a strand of bloody spaghetti. Tyler Jacobson was aroused by the motion I made as I ran from Robbie's Ford Explorer. He watched me for a moment while he excreted a foamy white meringue of bug shit onto the blacktop between his two hind legs. Tyler Jacobson was already hungry again. Bo Barton emptied his M16 on the unstoppable soldiers. He tried to run back toward Ollie Jungfrau's van when his gun stopped firing. Unstoppable soldiers are very, very fast. Travis Pope sprang with a single jump over the armored vehicle the guardsmen had been driving. Travis Pope landed directly on top of Bo Barton. It was like a cat playing with a very small mouse. Travis Pope pinned Bo Barton with his two middle legs. Bo Barton wriggled and squirmed. Travis Pope lowered his triangular face, opened his massive jaws, and bit off everything that had once been Bo Barton from the armpits up. Travis Pope chewed and chewed. The sound was like a starved barbershop quartet engaged in a buffalo wing eating contest. I raised my paintball gun. I thought about saying something dramatic. History, when told truthfully, will show that boys never really do make heroic statements while engaged in battle. Historians craftily pen those things in after the fact. I had nothing to say. But I did think about St. Casimir's. I thought about my brother, Eric Christopher Zerba. I wished he could watch what was happening here on the Kelsey Creek Bridge on satellite television. I thought about my mother and father, too, and I was convinced I would never see them again. And I thought about my balls, Orville and Wilbur. I cannot say why I thought about my balls, only that I did. All of that ran through my mind in the exact span of time it took for me to pull the trigger on my paintball gun. That is the truth.
Bap, bap,
went the paintballs. At that exact moment, Tyler Jacobson sprang toward me.
Pop, pop, pop,
went Robbie Breeze's paintball gun. Robbie naturally chased after me when I ran from the car. Robbie Breeze truly was a superhero. If unstoppable soldiers are capable of showing expressions with their mechanical faces and massive compound eyes, then both Tyler Jacobson and Travis Pope looked at each other in confusion and stunned defeat, possibly horror. I shot Travis Pope a third time, a direct hit into his thoracic joint. The unstoppable soldier broke completely in half.
Fuck yeah!
I said. I had never killed anything bigger than a freshwater perch in my entire life. There was something exhilarating and pure that rushed through me in that moment. I am almost embarrassed to say that it felt somewhat sexual and made me kind of horny. It is the truth. This is why assholes in charge of shit convince boys to go to war, I believe.
Fuck yeah!
Robbie said. Robbie Breeze felt the same thing. Tyler Jacobson staggered away from the front of the guard's vehicle. As he stumbled backward, he began disassembling. Clop, clop, clop. In detached segments that looked like goat-sized green lobsters flailing around in puddles of cheesy, shimmering yellow goo. Robbie? I said. Yeah? Robbie answered. Are you okay? I said. Robbie Bree said, yep. And I said, that was probably one of the top three most bitchin' things I have ever done in my life. Robbie said, the only way it could have been better, Porcupine, is if we were on our skateboards when it happened. Robbie Breeze was the brightest boy on the planet called Earth. At that exact moment, in a small house across Ealing, on Onondaga Street, the unstoppable soldier that had once been Eileen Pope came out into the blue plaid Iowa afternoon. She was very horny and very hungry. And her eggs were hatching. Great Big Jar. We transferred our belongings from Robbie's dead Ford Explorer into the National Guard armored vehicle. Robbie drove. The armored vehicle did not have a cassette tape deck. It would have been a perfect time to listen to Exile on Main Street.
They should put tape decks in this shit, Robbie said.
They don't even have a lighter for our fags, I pointed out.
What could they possibly have been thinking? Robbie offered. Anyone knows boys are better soldiers when they can smoke cigarettes and listen to the Rolling Stones.
We are unstoppable, I said. It was just as well. I had matches, and half a pack remained of my Benson and Hedges cigarettes. I lit one for Robbie, and then reached across and put it into his mouth. I touched his lips. I was still very confused about everything. I cared so much for Robbie Breeze. I would do anything for him. But at that exact moment, I was worried about Shan Collins, and I needed to get back to Eden. What was I going to do? I caught Connie Breeze watching me when I put a lit cigarette into Robbie's mouth and my fingers touched his lips. Connie Breeze smiled. I said. Robbie said, thanks, Austin. I lit a cigarette for myself and passed the pack and matches to Robbie's mom. Lewis did not smoke. Ingrid yawned. Robbie and I explained as much as we could. It was really too much to fit inside one car ride. And who could ever expect Connie Breeze and Lewis Awong Singh to make any sense of what had been happening in Ealing anyway? It would take time. Robbie and I smoked. Robbie Breeze sang Let It Loose. I had to be quiet when he sang because the sound of it made me want to cry. In a good way. I ain't in love. I ain't in luck. After he finished, Robbie said, there are other unstoppable soldiers out there somewhere. I nodded. I said, what can we do, Rob? Robbie said, it is a big jar we're in, Austin. It's a great big jar, I said. Here is what the end of the world looks like. It looks like a child running out into the road, eyes focused only on some destination ahead, the future, which is on the other side. And the child fails to notice the speeding truck that is there, on that same road in the present. This is what the end of the world looks like. All roads cross here.
The thump!
Robbie slammed on the brakes. The armored vehicle completely ran over the small pedestrian, front wheels and back wheels.
Shit!
Robbie said.
Ugh,
I said. We sat there for a moment, not really knowing what to do. What do you do when it is the end of the world and you run over some dumb kid who jumps out in front of your armored vehicle? I will go look, I said. I climbed down from the cab. In truth, I was afraid to look at the road behind us and come face to face with the bloody mess that would be there. This is history. I was standing in the present, looking back at the past with the empty road ahead of us. What could I do? And in the road behind us, stiffly clambering up onto shaky legs, was a dark, confused, unstoppable soldier that stood no taller than shoulder height to me. And it was hungry. I ran before the thing realized I was food. Holy shit! Holy shit! Holy shit! Excrementum sanctum. I slammed the door shut just as the hungry beast crumpled its arms against the side of the cab.
What the?
Robbie began. Then he saw the folded, spiked arms of the unstoppable soldier as they scraped against the bulletproof window on my door. Gun it, Rob, I said. This is what the end of the world looks like. Leaping and skittering over the strands of barbed wire that lined the highway out toward the old McKeon house came dozens and dozens, hundreds and hundreds, of little, hungry, and horny unstoppable soldiers.
Holy shit, Rob said.
Holy shit, I agreed. We drove. I lit another cigarette. Epilogue. Lucky, a cigarette run, and the bison. I call the boy Lucky. It is only a nickname for the kid. In the dead of a bitter Iowa winter when he was born, inside the same examination room where Wendy McKeon filled syringes with Robbie Breeze's blood, I gave him the name Eric Unzace Gerba. I also reclaimed my stolen consonants. I write in the library. The walls have been adorned with every imaginable beast and totem. A bison, a two-headed boy, an unstoppable soldier, a volcano in Guatemala, praying hands, a Stan Prime pizza, a sign that says roof access, arrow up. You know what I mean. Today is March 29th, but spring has not taken hold above us yet. It is also Robbie Breeze's 21st birthday. We are going out on a cigarette run today. I will explain. Lucky, Eric, is 4 years old. We have been living in Eden for a long time. Wendy McKeon made rules about things like when boys and girls can take showers, and there was a new history. The new history is Eden's. What I have written here is not the history of Eden. It is the history of the end of the world. All real histories will be about everything, and they will stretch to the end of the world. The end of the world started when Unze Sturba slid into the cold sea as his boy, Kreis, watched and wept and drifted closer and closer to the United States of America. Nobody knew anything about it. There are more of us now. The citizens of the new universe include Robbie Breeze, Shan Collins, Johnny and Wendy McKeon, Connie Breeze, Louis Awong Singh, and my son Eric. Connie Breeze also gave birth to a baby, a girl named Amelie. Amelie Singh Breeze is a real dynamo of an Eden name. We did what Dr. Grady McKeon told us we needed to do. And Ingrid is here. She lies beneath my feet as I write. I continue to be torn between my love for Shan Collins and Robbie Breeze, but I no longer care to ask the question, what am I going to do? Sometimes it is perfectly acceptable to decide not to decide, to remain confused and wide-eyed about the next thing that will pop up in the road you build. Shan does not like it. Robbie Breeze asks me to live with him. I stay in my own room, which I share with my strong Polish son, Eric, and we are very happy. Robbie Breeze and I ventured out into the world above during a snowstorm, in the first winter after the end of the world. We were correct in assuming the unstoppable soldiers would either leave Iowa or hibernate during wintertime. We armed ourselves with the blood of God in any event. It was reckless and wild, going out with Robbie. It was just like everything Robbie Breeze and I ever did together for our entire lives. Nobody else would come with us. We began to call these trips our cigarette runs. Nobody knew anything about them. Of course, we had enough cigarettes in Eden to last us for years and years. We would be gone for days. It frightened the others. So we came back one time with battery-powered walkie-talkies that had a range of 15 miles. Robbie and I always went much farther than 15 miles. One time we'd gone all the way to Minneapolis. Robbie and I never found a single human being on the surface of the planet called Earth. I do not believe Robbie and I wanted to find anyone else. But we never said that aloud. We did not need to say such things. On our cigarette runs, we have killed a few unstoppable soldiers that stubbornly scavenged during wintertime. And Robbie Breeze and I always spend our nights together in the nicest abandoned hotels, penthouses, and mansions. It is fun and daring. It is on these cigarette runs that I have uncovered much of the history included in this audiobook. It is the truth. It is my job. From hand-scrawled calendars, newspapers, appointment books, pocket-sized digital voice recorders, bones, cast-off clothing, and inflatable whales, I have put things together the best that I can, and I know that you trust me. I have no reason to lie. Animals have come back in tremendous numbers. On our last cigarette run, just after Eric's fourth birthday in February, Robbie and I ran into a herd of deer standing across the I-35. There were thousands of them. The deer had already forgotten why they should be afraid of human beings. When we got out of the car we'd been driving, Robbie and I could walk right up to the animals and pet them. Robbie Breeze and I are the kings of the world when we are out on our runs. When we come back to Eden, tired and exhilarated at the same time, Robbie and I bring gifts home for the women and babies, new clothes and underwear, diapers, toys, food that does not come in army-issue cans, even sports cars and motorhomes. I always bring back books for the library. Books have everything in them. After the end of the world, you cannot learn a goddamned thing from a computer or a television screen. Nobody ever thought about that, how humanity could only be preserved by paintings on cave walls, or books, and vinyl recordings. Robbie Breeze always brings vinyl records home to Eden. I found an autographed copy of The Chocolate War. We own everything in the world, and Robbie and I stockpile whatever we might need if Eden breaks down. It is going to happen eventually. Things break down. History tells us that, even if we do not want to listen. Shan is quietly pouting, no doubt hiding inside her bedroom. She does not like it when Robbie and I go out on our runs, but it is Robbie's birthday. We need to do it. There is something inside all boys that drives us to go away again and again and again. Again is now. We have not been out all month, and soon it will be too warm and too dangerous for Robbie and me to leave. The unstoppable soldiers will come back. They always do. Robbie Breeze and I found a 2-man ultralight aircraft in the hangar at Cedar Falls Airfield. Just like Orville and Wilbur Wright, Robbie swears he is brave enough to try taking the thing up for a flight. We have checked the motor, and it runs fine. I think if I get drunk enough today, or shit like that, I will let Robbie Breeze talk me into sitting in that goddamned airplane with him and going up for his 21st birthday, as long as I can have a cigarette or two. He promises we will fly over Grasshopper Jungle in our own airplane, and Robbie will sing Rolling Stone songs and I will smoke cigarettes and spit on the planet called Earth, and we will shout the names of our balls from the sky. Johnny McKeon has never given up trying to contact other human beings. I believe there are others somewhere on the planet Earth. I cannot calculate how long an unstoppable diaspora could overrun every continent. I fantasize that my mother, father, and brother are all fat and speak German fluently. Maybe Polish. Johnny McKeon hooked up spools of flat, twin-channeled wires to the antenna posts on the television sets in the brain room. Every day he sits, watching nothing and listening to static, twisting and turning the knobs on the UHF and VHF adjustments. One morning last summer, Johnny McKeon came running from the brain room shouting, "I'll be danged! I'll be danged! I found someone!" Naturally, we all ran to see what Johnny McKeon had found on the televisions in the brain room. When we got there, there was nothing. Johnny McKeon swore he'd seen a portion of an old episode of a program called Gunsmoke. James Arness was the star of Gunsmoke. Johnny McKeon has been losing his mind down here in Eden. He watches the televisions every day. Wendy McKeon makes rules. Robbie and I do not follow Wendy McKeon's rules very well. Ah Wong Sing cooks. He is a real dynamo at cooking. Connie Breeze has a 230 bowling average. Before we leave, Robbie, Eric, and I take a piss together in the giant nightingale urinal. It is what we do. One day, I will tell Eric about Chris Sturba and Eva Nightingale, and all the rest of our history. Eric is a good boy. "I will look for a coonskin cap for you when Robbie and I are out, Lucky," I say. Eric looks up from where he is peeing and says,
"What's that, Tata?"
Eric calls me Tata. "You will see," I say. Ingrid is up above, shitting in the snow. Robbie and I make several trips up and down, transporting things we want to take with us on our run. This trip we are driving a BMW X5. We took it brand new from a dealership in Peoria, Illinois, where if anybody was still alive, Robbie Breeze and I would be wanted outlaws. Once the car is loaded, Robbie and I say goodbye to the other new humans. Shan is tough. She kisses us both and tells Robbie to be careful. I still enjoy watching Shan kiss Robbie Breeze. Robbie tells her that he will bring her back a Rolex wristwatch. Shan Collins has 4 Rolex wristwatches. It is a joke. I would have a difficult time imagining anything as useless in Eden as a Rolex wristwatch. I say we will bring back cases of cup of noodles. That makes everyone happy. Cup of noodles is Eric's favorite meal. Eric gets to climb up the ladder with us. The boy has only been outside a handful of times in his entire life. Robbie is warming up the BMW. I still do not drive very well, although Robbie has taught me how to do it. Eric forms an icy snowball in his little pink hands. It is a game. All boys do this, just as all boys build roads that crisscross and carry us away.
Pow, Tata! You are dead,
Eric says. Tata is Polish for daddy. The snowball hits my thigh and I feign injury. I scoop a handful of snow and return fire, purposely missing the boy. The hatch is open. Lewis and Shan poke their heads above the rim, like timid gophers. I light a cigarette. Robbie gets out of the car and trudges across the snow to say a last goodbye to Eric. Like his father, Eric also loves Robbie Breeze very much. In the swirling fog of smoke that rises in front of my face, I notice a large figure moving in the field beyond a row of parked motorhomes and Cadillacs. Holy shit, I say. Robbie has a paintball gun at his side. We never go without one.
Holy shit,
Robbie says.
Austin?
Shan calls nervously. Shan cannot see what the three of us are looking at.
What is it, Tata?
Eric, who I call Lucky, asks. Across the field, I can see them. There are three of them at first, and then I realize it is an entire herd. Massive, dark, horned, and humpbacked. North American bison. The buffaloes have come to Iowa, to Eden. It is a big hairy thing, I say. And that was our day. You know what I mean.
This is Philip Church. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Grasshopper Jungle by Andrew Smith. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Listen Up Audiobooks. Grasshopper Jungle is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2014. All rights reserved. The book Grasshopper Jungle is available wherever Dutton books are sold.